Hello everyone, my name is Sarah Shaver. I'm currently a master's student at Tarleton State University. Today I'm going to share my research on how soil microbes change across the field with similar soils. So, soil microbes are responsible for most of biogeochemical cycling. In particular, they are known for the breakdown of organic matter, and they are also responsible for nearly all the steps within the nitrogen cycle. While most organisms are capable of producing only one of the steps within the cycle, there are many organisms within each step capable of performing that metabolic pathway. So, the microorganisms, like all other organisms, depend on a number of factors within their environment to meet their needs for energy, water, and habitat. Some of these factors include things like soil moisture, pH, texture, and the availability of nutrients such as nitrogen. And it's important to remember that these factors can be related to each other. For example, many nutrients are available depending on what the pH of your soil is. So what is the consociation soil map unit? For those of you who might not remember it, this map here is showing the soil map units delineated in orange. A soil map unit is a geographical collection of soils with similar properties, generally the same soil series. And while we like to think of soil map units as having clean-cut delineations, no impurities whatsoever, that is rarely the case. Often there are changes in soil-forming factors across the landscape that allow pockets of other soils to be within our soil map unit, but these pockets can be so small it's not easy for us to map these out. So a consociation soil map unit is the most pure form of map unit. It may have 15 to 25% of other soil series in the map unit, as long as it does not significantly impact land use interpretations. Now, while these land use interpretations might not be impacted, these other soils might actually be impacting soil microbial communities. So, the objective of our study was to determine whether the microbial communities are homogeneous across the field that had the same soil mapping unit. And we predicted that because of similar properties that yes, the microbial communities would be relatively similar throughout the field. So we started by sampling in Erath County, Texas. It's in central Texas. We sampled in a field that is being used as a hay production field. It previously had dairy waste applied to it for nutrients. However, it did stop. They did have to stop when their phosphorus content got too high. We randomly identified 10 sampling locations across the field that you can see here in yellow dots. And I should tell you, this field is about a third of a square kilometer. All of it is mapped as a Windthorst fine sandy loam with 1 to 3% slopes. For those of you interested in the taxonomy of a Windthorst, it is a fine, mixed, active, thermic, eutic paleostoff. So we randomly located our 10 sites, and for each site we sampled only the surface horizon, the genetic horizon. This was an AP horizon, and in most of our sites that was about 6 to 8 centimeters deep. So in the middle we took one sample, we dug a pit by hand, and it was about a meter long, so we took it all across that meter, so it's pretty representative. And then within 6 to 8 meters, we took 4 additional samples around that original site. So we have a total of 5 samples per site and a total of 50 samples. Once we took our soil samples, we took it back to the lab, dried it, ground it up, sieved it to 2 millimeters. We analyzed phosphorus using a Malic-3 extractable method. And for the genomic side, we extracted the DNA of prokaryotes and amplified it using PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. After that, we sequenced it on a MiSeq instrument. Any of our sequence reads that had poor quality, we discarded those reads, and the remaining reads were classified into groups based on 97% genetic similarity. We call these operational taxonomic units, or OTUs. So once we had those OTUs, we identified the taxonomy using the Green Genes database. We did all this analysis after sequencing using a program, CHIME. We started by looking at alpha diversity, or the species within a sample, and then we looked at beta diversity, or how the species changed among samples. So we were looking for apparent differences. We then tested those apparent differences using a combination of Kruskal-Wallis nonparametric ANOVAs and Mann-Whitney-U tests. So what did we find? Well, to start off, we had about 200,000 sequences among all of our samples. On average, there were approximately 3,811 sequences per sample with a standard deviation of 2,900 sequences, so it was pretty variable. We did rarefy our samples to 805 sequences, so all the samples had the same number of sequences for comparison purposes. And about 5 of our samples did not have enough sequences, so we had to discard them before we could move on. So the distribution of those samples. This graph is showing you OTU abundance. So for each OTU, how many sequences did we find? And that's on the x-axis. On the y-axis, we have the frequency. So how many of OTUs had that specific abundance? Please look at the break in the graph. I had to put that in there so we could see something besides the one bar. 92% of all of the OTUs had 20 or fewer sequences in them, while less than 2% had 100 or more sequences. So we have a lot of really, really rare OTUs. If we change this up a little bit to look at it by site, so on the x-axis, this is not the site number, but this is how many different sites each OTU appeared in. And again, on the y-axis, we have the frequency. So here we have a little bit of a slightly different story. We still have that many of the OTUs were rare. If there's only a few sequences, they're not going to be in very many different sites. But we do have a lot of OTUs that, regardless of how many times they appeared, they were distributed in all of our sites. So in order to look specifically at what the sites look like, this graph is showing the number of sequences per sample. So I told you we rarefied to 805 sequences per sample. If we chose to rarefy further down, that's what the x-axis is showing you. On the y-axis, we have the number of different OTUs that we found. And our error bars are standard deviation. So each of those lines represents a different site, and you can see they're all very similar to one another. Site 9 is a little bit on the low side, but still those error bars are overlapping with many of the sites. So they all have roughly the same number of different OTUs. However, this graph is not showing us which OTUs are present at which sites or what the relative abundance looks like. So in order to get a better look at the community structure, we looked at a principal coordinate analysis. So each sample is its own dot on here. They are again color coordinated by site. So you can see there's a little bit of clustering based on the site. And these sites here, for example, these are all from site 9. You can see they're relatively close together, which means they're more phylogenetically similar to one another, and they're farther apart from everything else. Unlike this cluster right here, this is samples from sites 5, 7, and 8. They're all very close together, intermixed. So we interpret this to mean that the community at site 9 is all similar to each other, but it's different from the rest of the field, and sites 5, 7, and 8 are all very similar to each other phylogenetically. So, to look at relative abundance, I compared the relative abundance of all the phyla and all the OTUs within each site, and I found exactly no significant difference anywhere within each site. So it's telling me that within that 6 to 8 meter radius, it's all pretty similar. So then I compared among the sites, and what I did find is we had 4 phyla and 4 OTUs that were significant among our sites. I know this graph is a little busy, please bear with me. On the x-axis, we have the site number, and on the y-axis, we have the average sequence count. Each bar is one of our 4 significant phyla, and we have error bars, again, representing standard deviation. So our 4 significant phyla were Varicomicrobia, Actinobacteria, Chloroflexi, and TM7, which is a candidate phyla. So you can see here pretty easily Actinobacteria is the most abundant of these 4. It's a bit of a generalist and is typically found everywhere in soil, so that makes sense. And TM7 is the least abundant. It's a new phyla. We don't know too much about it. I hope you learn more soon. So we discovered that there is some variation based on site. And while these phyla are associated with site, simply distance alone is not going to cause an impact in microbial abundance. There has to be something that's changing with that distance that makes the microbes change. So I told you we measured phosphorus. This graph here is showing the 3 phyla that significantly varied by phosphorus. So we had Actinobacteria, Chloroflexi, and TM7. So we have the phosphorus on the x-axis. Again, that's malic-3 phosphorus. And we have the abundance of actinobacteria, chloroplexy, and varicomicrobia on the y-axis. So you can see here, actinobacteria and chloroplexy both increased as phosphorus increased. Usually because phosphorus is an important macro element, it makes sense, they have more nutrients, so their abundance is increasing. Varicomicrobia, on the other hand, did the exact opposite. Likely it is more competitive at lower nutrient levels, and as the nutrients increase, other organisms are able to outcompete it. What's interesting here is that the three phyla that are significant with phosphorus are three of the four phyla that were significant based on site. So this is telling us it's not the fact that you're moving from point A to point B that's changing, but the nutrients within that site are changing. Excuse me. And the change in that nutrients is impacting the environment, and thus it's impacting the microbial communities. So we started out all this to say, is our soil microbial communities similar across the soil? And we thought we would find the answer is yes. Well, we did find within that small radius of 6 to 8 meters, the answer is yes, they're all the same. When you move to a larger scale and look across the whole field, you do find some variation. And this variation is likely impacted by other properties within the soil. So here I looked at phosphorus. Phosphorus is definitely not the only factor that's changing across the field. It could be pH, it could be other nutrients. So this has huge impacts in future soil sampling efforts and biogeochemical cycling. So if we were to sample on a core scale, if we were to aggregate our samples together, we would still probably find the organisms like Nitrous spira, which is a nitrate oxidizing organism, and Devosia, which is a nitrogen fixer. While these organisms are really important to study and understand, they're not fully representing the microbes that are active and functioning within the soil. So I found 4 more nitrogen fixers, 2 nitrate oxidizers, and 2 denitrifiers present in the soil, but they were in only 1 of my 10 sites. So if we were to aggregate samples together, likely we would not find them. So this has huge impacts on biogeochemical cycling. The take-home message here for you is soil sampling on a core scale could result in the loss of microorganisms that are important to biogeochemical cycling. And with that, I would like to thank my mentors, Dr. Brady and Dr. McGann, and Alan Dubler for his contributions, as well as AgriLife Research and Tarleton State University. Thank you. Yes?
So are you looking at other things that might have changed besides the nutrients? What about other microorganisms that are in bacteria?
So this particular primer was looking at both bacteria and archaea. I didn't find a whole lot of archaea in there. It is definitely possible that things like protozoa and fungi could be changing, and because of the interactions between the species, that would have an impact. However, because of funding and other limitations, we didn't do that. It would be really interesting to study that, though. Yes?
In addition to looking at soil properties to explain your variability,
So as far as topography goes, I did not actually measure that, and I was not the one to take these field samples, unfortunately, otherwise I could tell you what I observed. Looking at it from the soil map and looking at the slope on there, there does seem to be a little bit of a slope, so that could definitely have an impact. And that's probably actually impacting where the phosphorus is accumulating, and therefore everything else as well. Yes?
Was that total or extractable phosphorus?
It was malic-3 extractable phosphorus.
Thank you.
Thank you.